This episode of Sundays with Kate is sponsored by Masami, a premium hair care line with a Japanese ocean botanical called Mikabo. Masami was created to give your hair the ultimate in botanical hydration. Your hair will feel more manageable, softer, shinier, and overall healthier after just one use. Masami is gender neutral with light, fresh scent, available as shampoo, conditioner, styling cream, and shine serum. All designed to be lightweight, non-greasy, with good ingredients, vegan, and cruelty-free. Find us at lovemasami.com. LOVEMASAMI.com.
What do you do on Sundays?
We talk about Cate Blanchett, the acting, the costumes, the awards, but mostly the Blanchett of it all.
Oh, I'm not acting.
You think this is a love affair?
I saw you, Erica,
meeting in the middle.
This is Sundays with Cate, and I'm your host, Murtada El-Fadl.
Welcome to a new episode of Sundays with Kate. This is Murtada El-Fadl, and this is our podcast series about the films of Cate Blanchett. And we have a couple of films for you today. But before we get into those, let me welcome my guest, Shelley Farmer. Hi, Shelley.
Hello.
Before we start talking about Kate, tell our listeners a little bit about you.
Hi, I'm Shelley Farmer. I am a writer for places like Paper Magazine, Slate, Roger Ebert, and I'm also the film publicist at the Brooklyn Academy of Music.
So we are talking about the episode of Documentary Now, Waiting for the Artists, which starred Kate and was released earlier this year. Later in the program, we'll also talk about Manifesto, the artistic project that she did with Julian Rosenfeld a couple of years ago that started an installation and became a movie. But let's start with Waiting for the Artist, which is an episode of the third season of Documentary Now. It is, as all of Documentary Now episodes are, a spoof of a documentary film. This time it's the Marina Abramović film, The Artist is Present, which is a 2012 documentary chronicling Abramović's exhibit and retrospective of the same title that ran at the Museum of Modern Art in New York in 2010. But let's talk Documentary Now. Shelley, you love this show, right?
I love this show. I cannot believe that this show exists. It is so specific and so niche, and it's so completely thorough that it can't be cheap to make. And it's also made by some very high-profile comedians who are surely very busy, and yet somehow this show, I guess, was like willed into existence by a bunch of film nerds who knew that they needed this in their lives.
It is so funny. I haven't watched a lot of episodes. Like, my first introduction to it was this episode, and then I went back and watched a few. Mm. It is so much fun.
It's great. Yeah, no, and it's if anyone is not aware of what it is, it's a series in which each episode satirizes a specific famous documentary. So they've done, like, Hoop Dreams, they've done Great Gardens, Jiro Dreams of Sushi. My personal favorite is one that was this season. It is a satire of D.A. Pennebaker's company original cast album called Co-op.
That was so much fun. I love that one. That was one of the very first ones I saw.
Yeah, it's got an incredible original score and just, like, beat for beat, so spot on about, like, 70s musicals where everyone is, like, having a mental breakdown because they're recording over 24 hours and they're all smoking packs of cigarettes all night long.
Company is so big in the culture right now. It's in Marriage Story. Yeah. It's coming to Broadway in a couple of months, so...
Yeah.
But we're here to talk about Waiting for the Artist, and this is the episode Kate plays Isabella Barda, mm-hmm. who is a take on Marina Abramović, and The Artist is Present. Like, Kate is known as this ace mimic, right? Like, she did Katharine Hepburn.
Yes.
She did Bob Dylan. But I actually, when I saw this, I have not seen The Artist is Present, and mm-hmm. I just thought it was a funny performance. But then I looked at just clips from The Artist is Present, and I was amazed about how spot on she is doing Marina Abramović.
Yeah, it's very, very accurate. To the extent that I was reading earlier today, I think it was ArtNet, had an interview with Fred Armisen where he talked about making the episode. Fred Armisen plays her sometime lover,
an artist called Demo,
artist called Demo, who is a bit of a fake.
He's not the real. He's not the real artist. The real artist is Isabella.
Yeah, who's it's vaguely based on Abramovich's relationship with the artist Ule. A bit more spiky and hard-edged.
Yeah, a bit more absurdist.
A bit more absurdist. But yeah, so in this interview, Fred Armisen said that that Cate Blanchett's dedication to this was such that they filmed it in Budapest. And when she came onto set, she had gotten, like, false teeth put in so that she could more accurately, like, have her face look like Abramovich's and, like, mimic her speech patterns.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, she is a perfectionist.
Yes.
So the story follows kind of the artist's present story. So it is about Isabella Barta preparing for a retrospective, a retrospective of her art in her native Hungary. So they made her Hungarian.
Yes.
And they shot in Budapest. And so then during the half hour show, they get to recreate a lot of her previous exhibitions. And so you get kind of takes on a lot of Marina Abramovich's work. But the main sort of setup, the main story is about her inviting this ex-lover who is terrible, basically a terrible man, played by Fred Armisen, to come and share the exhibition with her. And then, of course, there is a twist, which is a very funny twist.
Yeah, and it's interesting because obviously Abramovich is like the main point of reference in this, but I, you know, I'm no artist, no expert on performance art. I'm like a complete dilettante, but like there are moments that feel like they are referencing other like famous works of performance art. Like there's one in which she has a bucket on her head with a smiley face painted onto it. It has to go answer a phone ringing in the middle of the room, and the men in attendance are told to put things all over the floor that she then like trips and falls on and becomes injured as she tries to do it. It's a great piece of like slapstick comedy, but it also echoes the Yoko Ono cut piece where, you know, people, she was sat in the middle of a room, people started cutting bits of her clothing off. Which then it's sort of like about like the hive mind of the audience. So, you know, people started out very, very slowly taking like small bits. And then by the end of it, like, especially the men became very emboldened. Like if you watch footage of it, there's like this one guy who like sort of peacocks up and like smiles out to the audience and then like starts cutting her top off and like cuts her bra straps. So that she has to like cover her breasts.
How awful. Yeah.
But yeah, so the episode is also like super attuned to the sexism in the arts world.
Yeah. We'll say it's not subtext, it's actually the text of it.
Yeah.
Is how basically Isabella is an artist who works for her art and is brilliant, but Demo doesn't do anything.
Yeah, he's and then like the charlatan who is sort of like a parasite on her work. Like they have one piece that is literally just like a recreation of her own work.
Yeah.
When he's asked about it in an interview, he's like, "Well, when she did it, it was one man, and when I did it, it's a two people."
So he's stealing from her, he's stealing her, he's stealing her thunder and getting all the credit. Like, even, like, the funny, there's a funny little bit where they do this performance piece where they have, she goes up the stairs and he's going down the stairs, even though going down the stairs is so much easier. He still takes the elevator and then starts talking to people. Yeah. And
they're both wearing ski boots, as they
And so, and even that, he messes it up and doesn't do his job, which makes it very, very funny. And Cate and Fred Armisen play off of each other very well.
And it's funny that, I mean, are we allowed to do spoilers?
No, sure. It's on Netflix. Everybody can see it. It's 27 minutes. Just, you can stop right now, go watch it, come back and listen.
But yeah, so I mean, the sort of like whole thrust of the narrative in this is that he is this sort of like freeloader, fake artist. It feels very of the moment, considering the Art Basel banana incident, in which, you know, an artist like taped bananas to the wall that were selling for like $120,000 that was then eaten by another another artist. But yeah, so like a recurring thing is that Demo, this other artist, is like, "I put on a show and my point is to not do any work. I go to the corner store the day before and I buy a bunch of crap." So you see her like sort of abjection throughout it as he like constantly uses her and gets acclaim for like doing no work while she pours her entire self into this. But the sort of twist at the end is that like he gets his comeuppance and then she tells the audience that like she was never really the victim in any of the scenarios, that because she's a woman in art, it's assumed that she must be a victim, but she actually was, you know, had control of everything the entire time because she's an artist.
Yeah.
Which I think also opens some interesting questions, because sort of like maybe straightforward reading of it is this sort of like feminist, like, you know, girl power thing of like, yeah, she actually outsmarted them all.
Yeah.
But I think it also opens some difficult questions about artists of like authenticity and, you know, life versus art, and like making your art out of your life. Mm-hmm. And does art lose its value if it lacks that authenticity, which mm-hmm. I think really connects to Manifesto in an interesting way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There are a lot of questions because both these artists, even though this is an absurdist half hour comedy, mm-hmm. like the characters, both of them use their life as their art. Mm-hmm. Everything they do is, it's performance art, but it's also using not just their life, but also their relationship with each other. And again, mm-hmm. they use it for their art, they use their art against each other. Mm-hmm. So it's, to your point, it's really interesting.
Yeah, it's a sort of like mutually parasitic relationship, even if like the Demo character maybe isn't aware of just how much she's using him as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it feels very cheesy to keep referring to Sondheim, but, you know, thinking of...
We can.
Yes.
He is part of the Documentary Now family, exactly. Right? They did an episode about company.
He's in the zeitgeist. But yeah, but it makes me think of, like, the song Finishing the Hat, and, like, yeah, that idea that, like, everything in your life is, like, simply grist for your art, and, like, is that, like, ultimately a sort of cruel way to live or an inauthentic way to live if, like, everything you do is mediated through this idea of using it to create art. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I think that, I don't know if they maybe intended it as a more sort of straightforward, like, she wins moment, but I also found it, like, kind of troubling as well.
Yeah, and that's what makes, like, this is, you know, a TV show, a half-hour comedy TV show, mm-hmm. but to just all these things that you brought up, it's so much deeper than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's very smartly written. Yeah.
And would you say, if we just go a little bit away from this episode, would you say that all the episodes are that this way? Since I think you've watched them all, right?
I haven't watched them all. I think that this one more so than a lot of the other ones. And I think because it's so dependent on what film it's parodying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And maybe this one brought these things.
Yeah,
to the
I think that this one inevitably raises those questions, just like by virtue of the sort of art that like Abramovich does, and like the sort of movie that the artist is present is.
Mm-hmm. And I also would like to think that, you know, the people behind the series were just, when they got an actor of Cate Blanchett's caliber, mm-hmm. maybe they raised their game a little bit more.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, because yeah, this is like super detailed. Like, I mean, if you look at something like, they're like Jiro Dreams of Sushi parody. I think it's called like Juan Loves Chicken or something. that it's a lot more sort of like straightforward, funny, heartwarming family story. Yeah. It doesn't have necessarily all these like layers about like authenticity and representation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I want to talk a little bit about Kate's performance. I think she is so funny.
She's great.
It's so funny in this role. She usually sometimes plays ridiculous. Like she has mm-hmm. done, you know, Indiana Jones and she has done Cinderella, where she plays these very ridiculous big performances in studio movies. Mm-hmm. But I don't think she's ever been this funny as she is in Waiting for the Artist.
Yeah, I mean, something that I find interesting about her as an actor is her sort of like hyper theatricality and the sort of like archness that I think mm-hmm. is present in pretty much all of her performances that I've seen. Like, she's not someone that I look to for, you know, naturalism. I think that when she finds truth in her performance, it's usually through artificiality. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that being said, this performance has a lot of affect to it. Like, she's got the fake teeth. She's got like the accent. She does like Marina Abramovich's laugh. Like brought earlier where she's like,
I know. I totally, that was so funny. That scene where she's like, I'm feeling it in my uterus. And then she does the laugh. And I thought that was just something she did. But then when I saw Abramovich, she does that.
Yeah, it's perfect. But that being said, it's like there are all these elements of artificiality to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's such a like full bodied performance. Like mm-hmm. you see her doing these like art pieces within the film. Like, they have all these, you know, quote unquote, like archival performances on film. And it's her like running and throwing herself against a wall. Like, her like doing this like slapstick stuff of like falling on her ass, like as she's like slipping on a skateboard. Like, that there is like full commitment to it, which is really
And impressive. They shot it all in like 9 days.
Yeah.
And she did all these things. Like, she was inside the refrigerator and doing all these things, and you know, it's crazy. She's very committed.
Mm-hmm.
I also love the tenderness that she brought to the performance. She was completely non-judgmental of this woman, Isabella Barta. And I think this is what Sam Adams in Slade gets at in his review, and I'll quote it here. "There is a genuine and familiar tragedy underneath Blanchett's Slavic accent, and she doesn't play the part for laughs. There's humor in the episode, but it's the humor of recognition, not release. Even if it's fiction, Waiting for the Artist still feels like it's documenting something real." The accent, obviously, she's somebody who nails accents all the time, wherever she is, wherever, whoever the character she's playing is from, the accent is always perfect. And this one
was... Well, I would disagree with that based on Manifesto, but continue.
Well, we'll get to Manifesto, but like, I was thinking of like doing Katharine Hepburn or doing The Gift, or when she does The Missing, or all these other where her perfect sort of New York Upper East Side accent is in Blue Jasmine. And this is another one. She got Marina Abramovic. The cadences, the accent, the way she talks. I just love, like, I can hear it in my head right now when she's like, it's supposed to be radical.
Yeah.
And I can't do the accent.
Sure, sure.
But it's just so funny because what she's saying is funny, but also just the way she says it.
I'm very nervous. This is a big deal, I tell you. Got pain in my uterus already. Each room has one of my historic pieces performed by someone else. And then I will be here in the last room. And then I cover the walls in gasoline. Then I light the gasoline, big fire. And then I run out of the museum before it burns down. What don't you like?
Fire is very unsafe.
And... Yes, but art is not supposed to be safe. It's supposed to be radical.
But there are still rules to starting fires indoors.
Whose rules?
The city. We could apply for permits.
No. It's ruined.
You were doing Fred Armisen earlier, and you were much better than I am.
Thank you.
Finding
Grazie.
It.
Yeah, no, it's... But yeah, I think she's really great with the accent work on this.
Yeah, amazing, precise accent work. So I think we both recommend Waiting for the Artist, right?
It's, oh, it's so
it's,
good.
It's only 27 minutes. So much fun.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, it's great. I mean, honestly, you know... Sorry, no shade to Julian Roosevelt, but I think that... This is a much more interesting portrait of the artist than Manifesto.
So Manifesto is the other Cate Blanchett project that we are talking about today. It was an installation that became a film. So it is directed by Julian Rosenfeld, who is an artist. This is the official synopsis. So it's a little bit pretentious. It says, Manifesto pays homage to the tradition and literary beauty of artistic manifestos, ultimately questioning the role of the artist in society today.
To put out a manifesto, you must want ABC to fulminate against 1, 2, 3.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. All current art is fake. Nothing is original, okay? So you can steal from anywhere that resonates with inspiration and fuels your imagination, okay?
So it's basically 12 artistic manifestos, all of them delivered by Cate, wearing 13 different characters. So she plays 13 different characters. And when you say plays, they're not full characters. Sure. There is just, it's the makeup, the hair, the way she looks. The costumes are different from scene to scene. There is one of them where it's actually two of her. Mm-hmm. So she plays off herself. But they're not full characters because they don't have a story. All they do is either they deliver the manifesto straight to the camera, or the manifesto is sort of read in the voice of the character while they shoot. Mm-hmm. But it is sort of virtuoso. I think one of the MVPs of this is definitely the makeup and hair designer, because she plays a homeless older man. She plays British punk rocker.
Yeah.
She plays, I think, an Eastern European, maybe a choreographer, a very angry woman at a funeral. So these are just, so there's 13 of them, but these are just some of them. This was an installation first, and then it became a movie. And I think they made it a movie because they wanted to pay for the installation, basically. Mm-hmm. I saw the installation at the Armory in New York, and I have to say the installation was better than the movie. What do you think, Shelley?
I did not see the installation. I'm sort of torn on the film. I think that there are parts that are very interesting. I think that as a showcase for her technical ability as an actor, it's very impressive. Like you said, she's not really playing sort of like layered characters. She's playing these sort of like broad archetypes. And mm-hmm. I think it was like surely a fun exercise for her to like put on these different wigs and try out different accents. And
to do it all in 9 days or 7 days,
something
ridiculous
crazy.
Like that.
Yeah. And it was clearly, it's funny that you mentioned that they did the film to get the budget basically for the gallery, mm-hmm. Because it looks incredibly expensive.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I find something sort of, I'm still sort of sorting through my thoughts on this, but I find something vaguely suspect about the premise. It's like we were talking earlier about like when this movie came out and when the Documentary Now episode came out.
Yeah.
We were a little bit unsure on like when the movie itself actually came out, but the gallery at least was in 2015.
Yes.
And it feels very much of that time. It feels very sort of pre-Trump in mm-hmm. that it's this sort of like self-reflective, metatextual art for art's sake
yeah.
piece.
A bit navel-gazing, right?
It's a bit navel-gazing, but more than that, I think it's interesting that it's taking these different artistic manifestos that, generally speaking, something like this where people set down these sort of like rigorous rules for like art and meaning and like ways in which we should pursue truth, they often come out of times of like tumult or, you know, particularly like political suffering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's, the piece has a sort of like kind of like flip attitude towards them. Like it, the way that they're contextualized is oftentimes like almost condescending.
Is there one in particular you're thinking of?
Well, this one I don't mind so much because it doesn't feel like it was coming out of such like a sort of like fraught political moment.
Mm-hmm.
But the scene where she's playing the school teacher reciting the Dogma 95 manifesto is
yeah.
a real fuck you to the dogma movement because she's literally playing a school teacher to small children reciting this manifesto and then going amongst the students like she's giving it to them as an assignment.
Yeah.
And going amongst them as they're like writing on their papers and going like, oh, no, we only use natural light. No, we don't use genre. Like, it's especially coming at, like, almost the very end of this project that is, like, pure artifice and is, like,
mm-hmm.
so, like, antithetical to everything Dogma 95 was advocating
yeah.
for, which, like, I'm a, you know, the biggest fan of, like, the Dogma 95 films, but it's, like, but it was actually kind of funny in the way that it was, like,
yeah, they were definitely
fuck off.
commenting on
yeah.
Dogma 95, because to your point,
right.
everything about this is not Dogma 95.
Yeah,
like,
right.
they spent most of, I think, the time in creating these
mm-hmm.
fake characters
right.
by wigs and makeup and
yeah,
costumes
right.
and everything
mm-hmm.
and her playing all the parts, which is fake too, which
yeah.
total antithesis to Dogma 95.
Right.
Yes. And then it's like Dogma 95 will make a scene with kids.
Yeah. Like the fact that she's literally speaking to children in this didactic way. It's like, okay, we get it. You think that like Dogma 95 is simplistic and like juvenile, but even like the Dada segment where she's literally delivering at a funeral as
mm-hmm.
she's like, death to culture. It's like a bit on the nose.
Yeah.
But yeah, but it is interesting, like, you know, something like Dada that was coming out of like a very tumultuous period.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's even just like the idea of stacking these manifestos side by side, not creating any sort of like qualitative difference between them necessarily. Oftentimes the words are obscured by the sound design.
Mm-hmm.
It felt as though the film didn't take any of them seriously.
Yeah.
Which is
fine,
that's his project, but it's also, like, that feels weird in 2019, in a time mm-hmm. in which, like, I think a lot of artists were all currently trying to figure out, like, how does art respond to crisis?
Yeah.
And to see something that is so flippant about the idea that, like, art could have any sort of impact on that is
yeah.
interesting.
Yeah, it. I don't even think it works as a movie. So,
yeah.
having seen the installation, I was interesting in that you basically had to go around on your own
mm-hmm.
time. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, there were 12 installations
mm-hmm.
and it is the same segments that are in the movie they played.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is a point when they're all timed together. And there is a
mm-hmm.
point, which is the last bit in the movie, where all 12 installations come together. And wherever you are in the
mm-hmm.
exhibition, the screen will show the same things, and it will be 12 Cate Blanchett's basically coming at you, delivering that bit.
Sure.
So it had an effect as an exhibition that I think it completely loses it in the movie, and I don't think it works as a movie
at all. I mean, is that
all
the sort of like final image, the like sort of Brady Bunchy sort of thing where it's all the small... Yeah, okay, interesting.
But in the exhibition, you see that 12 times.
Okay,
because if you want to see every every installation, you have from one to the next.
Sure.
And by the end, you've seen it 12 times.
Got it. Okay.
And it's a cumulative effect.
Sure.
It's a cumulative effect.
Sure. Yeah. I think it's an interesting exercise. I do think that Rosenfeld a little bit is like hedging his bets.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe not hedging his bets, but maybe just like sort of like outright dismissing the idea of responsibility or of an idea that there can be a correct way to make art, which like is a completely fair perspective to have.
Mm-hmm.
But even the like the title cards used in the beginning, which, you know, he's got several quotes like saying from Malevich's Suprematism Manifesto, art requires truth, not sincerity. There's this Elaine Sturtevant, I think is how you pronounce it, quote that all current art is fake. And then this Jarmusch quote, which he says, nothing is original, steal from anywhere that resonates with inspiration or fuels your imagination. So it's this sort of like magpie process in which he's like borrowing from a lot of different people. And like at the end, there's a Godard quote that says like, it's not where you take things from, it's where you take them to in the Dogma 95 section. So it's this sort of like magpie mishmash that ultimately like signals to me that he as an artist doesn't really have any sort of code, which is... I mean, that in itself, I guess, is a stance, but it seems weird in the context of all of these, like, pretty, like, rigorous ideas of, like, what art is.
Yeah, I didn't get, either from the installation or from the movie, what the artist's point of view in this is. All I got is that they delivered these manifestos. There was definitely work and meticulous work in filming it and in the installation itself and in the performance, but to what end?
Right.
I don't know.
Right, and it's... It feels strange that, like, it doesn't feel like there's any sort of, like, center of gravity. Like, there's no essential point of view of, like, what makes good art, but, like, in the way that he has this sort of, you know, kind of condescending approach to something like Dogma 95, it's like, okay, so we know what you don't think is good.
But what do you think
is good? But what do you think is good?
Yeah. Yeah, there's no point of view. But it is... Like, there are fun aspects of it.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
So the performances, they're uneven. Mm-hmm. Not all of them work, but they are sort of fun. Like, I love the Dada segment, because it's just, she has the wig, she's covering her face, she's at a funeral, she's all in black, and then every time she will just throw Dada. And the way she says it, she changes the way she says it every time.
Uh-huh.
And it's just, as a performance piece, it's fun to watch.
Dada, 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 Dada.
Some of the other things I really enjoyed in this movie is that she makes a little doll of herself. That was fun to look at. She pays homage to Norma Desmond with her headscarf when she's playing the choreographer. And also, I think also in the Dada segment, it's very funny where Cate is dragging us all of us who are on Twitter, on social media, when she says, when discourse is opinion, when you don't have to know anything yet, you think you know everything. Drag us, Cate. Drag us. Loved it.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, like, as an exercise for Cate Blanchett, I think it's a really good time. But, and like, you know, maybe I need to see it again, maybe need a bit more distance, but I just truly couldn't dig down to, like, what's it all about, Alfie, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I sort of get, I guess, conceptually, this idea that, like, he is synthesizing all of these different artistic points of view, and he's having this one artist deliver them all with... sort of like the implication that like every artist contains like the entire history of art within them and contains all these multitudes. But I don't know, it just felt like a bit of a cop-out to me.
Yeah, maybe. But I want to go back to sort of like the conceptions of the character and the performance of it, because I don't know, what does this add to Cate's reputation as an artist, as an actor?
Mm-hmm.
She's primarily an actor of stage, of screen.
Mm-hmm.
So she did this collaboration with this visual artist.
Mm-hmm.
And because she is this world-renowned actor, then it became a movie. Mm-hmm. But sort of like, what does it do to her reputation? Or what does it add or subtract? Like, I think, for instance, if you compare it to Documentary Now, that is such a fun performance in a TV show. People can just enjoy it. It just shows that she can go, she can be more fun than she is maybe sometimes. Mm-hmm. The roles that are given to her in movies afford her. Mm-hmm. But this one, is to me, is a little strange, is that it shows her versatility as an actor playing 13 characters in 94 minutes or and shooting them in 7 days. So hooray, that's that's definitely something, you know, it's an accomplishment. But I don't know if it adds anything to her reputation as an artist.
I would say from my point of view, I mean, my favorite performance that I have seen her do is when she did Uncle Vanya with the Sydney Theater Company that came to City Center. Mm-hmm. I thought she was gorgeous in it. Like, she struck, like, such a striking figure. Like, and she was, like, deeply, like, soulful and was able to play so many notes, whether it was, like, tragedy or, you know, this really, like, skilled comedy. But I think that you wouldn't know that she was an actor capable of that from watching this, because I think that this, as impressive as it is, I think it could also be lobbed against her as sort of proof of, I think, maybe a point of view that maybe some people have, that she is like a very skilled technician, but not necessarily like someone with a lot of soul.
Yeah.
And
and these characters don't have soul just because of the concept of the movie. Yeah.
Right, exactly. That they're really impressive technical achievements, and it shows someone who's like very in command of her voice and her physicality, but you wouldn't know that there's like maybe greater depth to her from this. But yeah, so I think it maybe like typifies like a certain type of Blanchette role that is maybe not like the most impressive part of her, you know?
Yeah, I love this sort of I've been reading reviews about Manifesto, so there's this quote from David Fear in Rolling Stone who says there is a story about a turn of a century theater queen, Sarah Bernhardt, reading the phone book so emotionally that the audience was left weeping. That's what Blanchette is doing here. She adds a human element. She can turn anything into art, even artistic navel gazing. And I think this comes back to what we were just talking about.
Sure.
I mean, she is compelling to watch because who wouldn't want to watch her do 13 episodes? And especially, I love that segment where she's talking to herself and she ends every sentence as both characters by saying Kate.
Yeah.
So it's like a fun moment, but it's also, it's just like, to what end? Like, I don't think it sort of adds anything. And the whole project, I do think the whole project is a little bit of a navel gazing, but it's also like, for someone like me who adores Kate, I enjoyed these 94 minutes because I got to see her play so many different things.
Sure. Yeah. And I don't know, it's interesting the David Fear quote, because the idea of that, like, you know, Sarah Bernhardt could bring you to tears. Nothing in this performance would bring me to tears. Like, I think I got most frustrated with this sort of, like, British punk, because it was just, like, so affected, and, like, there were so many, like, kind of, like, broad ticks, and, like, it felt like she was, like, aping archetypes that I've seen in movies before, rather than being a person.
In my glorious isolation, I am illuminated by the marvelous incandescence of my electrically charged nerves.
But yeah, the artifice of it was so apparent, which I don't have any problem with. I love theatricality in acting, and I like am a personal enemy of naturalism for the most part. But yeah, I found it more distracting. It felt like someone doing like an acting class exercise than it felt like a fully realized performance.
And maybe she and Rosenfeld had fun doing it, coming up with the concept. I mean, it says in the notes that I, you know, when I was doing research, that he sort of thought of the concept when he saw I'm Not There and saw what she was doing as Bob Dylan. And so he came up with this concept inspired by that. So I definitely think they probably had fun together working on it and collaborating. And I think the installation works better because there is just effect in the installation that you don't get from sitting in a movie theater or sitting at home watching this. So maybe, I don't know. I don't think this should have been a movie, but I'm happy that it's a movie, because I can just, if I want to watch Cate Blanchett say Dada for 10 minutes, I can just put it on.
Yeah, it's definitely got like a lot of like sort of like small pleasures in it. Though it is funny saying that it seems like they had fun on it. That's kind of like when you come out of a play and you're like, the set was gorgeous.
Yes. Totally.
Yeah. Your friend's like been in a show and they're like, what do you think? You're like, you're a costume designer. Great. Really impressive. guys seem to be having a lot of fun up there. Yeah.
I think they did. And I mean, I think also adding to the fun, not only was it Kate and Julian Rosenfeld, but also her husband and children appear in one of these segments. Yeah. And it's funny to see them sort of like acting with her, because they're probably just thinking, oh, we have to deal with one of mom's artistic projects.
So they're the kids and the husband at the dinner table. Is
yes.
that right?
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. But she had a very interesting Southern accent in that
yes. scene. It's not as good as The Gift.
I tell you, there are some of these actors who I think are just brilliant technicians, have great accents, but when they try to do American ones, it gets a little dicey. Yeah, no, I mean, I mentioned Kate Winslet earlier, but she's like the most egregious one for me always. She's always just like, oh my God, we gotta get out of here. What are we doing?
And listeners, if you can tell by now, Shelley is an actor too.
Yeah, now I feel bad criticizing a far superior actor.
Well, you know, accents, not everybody can do them.
This
there are
true.
Some people who cannot do an accent to save
yeah,
their lives. Like Nicole Kidman, who always sounds like Nicole Kidman, no matter where her character's
does.
From.
I know, Big Little Lies. I was like, I'm not sure where she's supposed to be from.
From planet Nicole Kidman.
There you go. And that's fine, because she's Nicole.
I want to mention one thing about, you know, one of the things that I really like about Cate Blanchett's performance is that mm-hmm. she is a technician, but she's also a master gestural actor.
Mm-hmm.
And she's somebody who uses her body well. She uses gesture so well
mm-hmm.
in performance. And this is one why I sort of enjoyed watching Manifesto, because
mm-hmm.
there's all these little gestures in
mm-hmm.
all the performances. For instance, when she was playing the TV newscaster.
Yeah.
They shot her at the beginning before the newscast starts, and she's changing her shoes
mm-hmm.
and she's like, you know, standing on one leg and then on the other. And it's just these little things that build a character. In a real movie, they would build a character. In this, it was just fun asides
right.
that are just fun to watch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think like her gait as the homeless man, I think that that's really fantastic. And, you know, to go back to seeing her in Uncle Vanya, like, her physical work in that show was just so incredible. And I mean, part of it is that, like, she's got this incredible, like, instrument at her disposal. She's
mm-hmm.
so tall and she's lean. And, like, when she first made her entrance in the play, she was, like, in this white suit. And just, like, her silhouette, she looked like a 50s fashion drawing. And, like, just the way that she knows how her body looks and that she can manipulate it to its best effect is really impressive. But I will say, when she was playing the British punk, she was doing a lot of arm stuff that I was like,
yeah.
tone it down!
I know. I think one of the reviews that I was reading said something about she needed the director to tell her exactly
yeah.
that. Tone down your arms.
Yeah.
So you're not alone,
happening.
Shelley. But so Manifesto, we're kind of mixed on. But, you know, if you love Cate Blanchett, we assume you do. If you're listening to this podcast, you can just go watch it. She plays 13 different characters. It's 90 minutes. Doesn't really work, but it's fun to watch just the performance of it.
And I also think that, like, it's very worthwhile to watch if you do it as a double bill with the Waiting for the Artist. Like, I think that they really complement each other really well.
Yeah, and that gives you 2 hours very well, 2 hours about being an artist and what it means.
Yeah.
And tell us more. Why do you think they complement each other?
I think that they're very interesting for the moments in which they're occurring. I think that this sort of, like, you know, obviously there were plenty of things for people to be angry about as artists prior to the Trump era. But I feel like it wasn't so much just like in the air of like the cultural consciousness of like having a sense of responsibility in art. So this happening in 2015, it feels like a bit more normalized. There would be this sort of like internal looking like art for art's sake sort of project. Whereas like, you know, Documentary Now episode is obviously like a half hour of silly comedy, but also the fact that like, it made a point of really addressing like gender imbalance in the art world, that it feels like it's taking seriously the idea that it needs to have something to say. Yeah, and I think just like seeing the way that she approaches performance in each one, the ways in which like a lot of the characters in Manifesto sort of feel like sketches, which I think makes sense considering like the time restraints and
mm-hmm.
the fact that they are such short performances. Whereas, like, she dug so deep on, you know, this half-hour TV show.
Yeah, that's the biggest surprise to me.
Yeah.
Is, like, this is, like, it seems like such a great concept for a performance. Like, mm-hmm. she really did her homework, got right. everything that she, and she had an idea about mm-hmm. Marina Abramovich. She had an idea about her art. She had an idea about how to perform it. Like, mm-hmm. it's so well modulated for just, you know, how short it is and what it is.
Yeah, and I think also the fact that Manifesto is sort of straightforward gallery art that sometimes feels like a parody of gallery art.
Yeah.
Whereas the Documentary Now episode is a parody of performance art that honestly sometimes hits on some, like, pretty conceptually, like, kind of moving pieces. Like, even if they're sort of ridiculous in their execution, like her with the bucket on her head. Like,
yeah.
It's a silly piece, but it's also one that
sad.
And you could see it happening in a gallery context and be mm-hmm. like, actually, that's pretty lovely.
Yeah. Yeah, that part of it was very sad to me. I'm like,
yeah.
wow, like, you know, somebody did go through this,
right,
and it
yeah.
was hurtful.
Right, yeah.
yeah. So yeah, Documentary Now, that episode is so brilliant.
Yes.
So now I'm going to ask you some questions about Cate Blanchett.
Excellent. How?
So do you remember sort of like your first introduction, what first movie you saw of hers?
Ooh. I think I can't remember a first time I saw her because it feels like she's just, like, been in the cultural consciousness for so long that, like, my entire time as...
Since the late 90s.
Yeah,
yes.
My entire time as, like, a movie lover, she's just been so present as someone who is, like, you know, known as this sort of, like, top-tier actor.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, I think that my sort of generalized impression of her is I often think of her and Tilda Swinton sort of in parallel because
mm-hmm.
they're sort of similar looking. They're both these sort of like, you know, theater trained actors who are sort of like affected, but, you know, are really fascinating to watch.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been interesting to see like how their careers differ because I feel like Tilda Swinton tends to go for like completely batshit projects. And then
yeah.
like she's someone that you can like trace from her time with like Derek Jarman. And then Cate works in like a sort of more mainstream way, but brings this sort of, like, artistic integrity to these kind of mainstream films.
Yeah. She does work with the biggest directors, like Scorsese,
yeah,
Fincher.
Right.
You know, yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, no, it's, yeah, she's interesting. She feels like someone who can bring a bit of, like, sparkle and integrity and strangeness to more mainstream work.
Is there a performance of hers or a movie of hers that only you like?
Only I like.
Or
oh.
some, you know, something that people don't, some performance that people don't talk about
yeah.
when they talk about Cate Blanchett.
I mean, I hate to keep going back to that Uncle Vanya performance, but honestly, it was huge for me. It was like a really, really big deal. It was her and Richard Roxburgh, and like, it's one of the best theater performances I've ever seen. The two of them together were electric.
Have you seen her Streetcar?
I haven't, no. Oh, God,
she was amazing
yeah.
in that. I think that's one of the best theater experiences I've ever had.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But you also love Oscar and Lucinda, right?
I do really love Oscar and Lucinda because I was a big fan of the book. And, you know, Gillian Armstrong is, of course, incredible. Yeah, and I think she's, like, really luminous in the role because in the book, I think that Lucinda is described as, like, a bit more of an oddball, someone that, like, a Tilda Swinton would maybe play.
Yeah.
But I like that she, especially because, like, Ralph Fiennes is doing a lot in the movie, that...
He's being the oddball, yeah.
Yeah, he's being the oddball. And so that she's, like, sort of grounded and that, you know, she's so young in it and she feels so, like, fresh and, like, bursting with energy. And, like, I think we now think of her as sort of this, like, not necessarily, like, a grand dame of the arts or whatever, but... But yeah, just to see her at that like early stage in her career, and
it feels different than what she does now.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's really exciting, and I mean, also, you know, I was not a very good film, but Ocean's 8, she's great.
Yeah,
she and Sandra Bullock have like amazing chemistry together, and like just to see her do something so like smooth and like sexy and tough, like it's really cool.
I think her character in Ocean's 8 is maybe the closest to her real life persona.
I think so, yeah.
And it's fun. It's almost Christmas, so it's
yeah.
carol time.
Ugh.
Carol Mass.
Yes.
So I'm assuming you love Carol.
I love Carol. The year that I came out, I threw a Carol themed Christmas party. I made everybody come dressed up in like 50s outfits. I made the like spinach and eggs. I love Carol.
So tell us something from Carol, a scene, a moment, anything that you particularly like about Carol.
Oh gosh, it's so hard. There's so much that's so great about it. I mean, the scene where Rooney Mara first comes over to her house is, oh God, just so lovely. Just, yeah, I feel like a lot of queer film lovers, like especially queer women, were always like asking for like something that's not just a period piece where people like steal glances, which I get, but just like this, the specificity and the delicacy of the ways in which like every minor touch that they share feels so freighted with meaning is, oh, just lovely. And the fact that they get a happy ending, that it doesn't have to be like the lesbians die, you know, it's
such a beautiful ending, but I just love what you said, that everything they do is, has meaning. Mm-hmm. And that's just, I think that's, a lot of people say nothing happens in this movie, and I'm like, well, maybe you weren't paying attention, because every minute so many things
happen.
Did you
see when she put her hands on her shoulders?
Did you see that look?
Yes. love a glove lunch.
Yeah. Carol is amazing.
Best.
So would you say that Rooney Mara is your favorite Blanchett scene partner? Or do you have somebody else in mind?
Oh, God, it's so hard. You know what? Maybe she is. Yeah, because Rooney Mara, I think, is really interesting on screen. Like, she's someone that I could never imagine, like, doing theater, because it seems like her power as a performer comes so much from, like, the way that the camera reads her face.
Yeah.
Which is so perfect for this film that is so much about these, like, small exchanged glances and, like, yeah, and the sort of, like, temperamental dynamic between the two of them that, like, Kate is, you know, pretty big and she's got a, like, huge force of personality and... That Rooney Mara is so, like, sort of sanguine and, like, withdrawn. It's, yeah, they've got a really lovely dynamic together.
They do. They complement each other so well. Mm-hmm. And Carol works because they're both in that movie at the top of their game, but also so different and giving such different performances.
Yeah, oh, totally. And they're both so hot.
Yeah.
Which doesn't hurt.
That doesn't hurt at all. Is there somebody that you would like to see her work with?
I was looking at her notes earlier and thinking about this, and I feel like there are a million people, but off the top of my head, I think my number one would be Michael Shannon.
Oh, wow. Wow. The minute you said it, I'm just,
right,
I want to see
right?
that.
Yes. Because I think they both have this sort of like theatricality, the sort of like mannered thing, but they also are so unbelievably charismatic and like can really hold the screen. Because I think that one of the challenges with like people acting against her is that like, her charisma is just so overwhelming that it's easy for the other person to get lost.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they would really, like, be each other's match.
Yeah.
And, I mean, honestly, I would love to see them do a play together.
Yeah. Ugh. And, you know, she is someone who goes back to the stage all the time.
Yeah.
She has never... I think she hasn't been on stage since The Present, which now is maybe 3 years. This is the longest time
it's
that I think she hasn't been on stage.
Yeah.
So it's about time, Kate, if you're listening.
Come on, Kate.
Get on Broadway with Michael Shannon.
Please. Oh, but to go back to screen partners,
yeah.
I love her and Rooney, but I gotta say, her and Richard Roxburgh together were so
on stage.
Good.
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I missed that Uncle Vanya, but I saw everything else that she brought to New York.
Yeah.
I saw The Maid, I saw Streetcar, I saw The Present, which had Richard Roxburgh.
Yeah, they've got a similar thing of like, he gets put in these kind of like small roles in films for the most part.
Yeah.
He's another one who's got like such presence and was like super charismatic, and he's like a very physical performer on stage.
And they have played so many roles together.
Mm-hmm.
They did so many plays together throughout the years. Shannon, Roxburgh, okay, do something together. That would be great.
I love it. Design for living with the three of them.
Yeah. But thank you, Shelley. This has been so much fun to talk to you.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on the podcast. And before we go, tell our listeners where they can find you and your work.
You can find me on Twitter at Shelley, SHELLEYB, Farmer, or you can visit my website, shelleyfarmer.com.
And give Shelley a follow on Twitter. She is a great follow.
I tweet so much. It's embarrassing.
It's fun, and it's about things I think if you're listening to this podcast, you will care about.
Thank you.
And I want to thank Shema Asaraf, who edited the Dada clip for this episode. And you can find me on Twitter at @ME_says and follow the podcast on Twitter and Instagram @SundaysWithKate. And until next time, thank you for listening.